Thanks so much for joining, and thanks especially to Rick for trying to make this all happen. We'll do our best and see how it goes. And you know, it's kind of an experiment. Globalism, you know, maybe needs a little bit of tweaking for it to be perfected. But it's amazing that we can even do this much. And we'll give it our best shot here to make it all happen. I'd like to welcome the seven centers and study groups that are joining us. I'll just go through them quickly so that everyone knows each other. The Singapore group is meeting for breakfast, I think. They're called the Three Jewels of Singapore. And the Melbourne group, Heart of Wisdom, is here. The Los Angeles Mahasukha Center, the Reno Diamond Heart Center, the Saskatoon Middleway Center of Saskatoon, the Cape Ann newly denominated Wisdom's Heart Center, and Nashville's Diamond Heart Center. So, so welcome, and you know, we can start by you know, setting our motivation of gratitude for, you know, for this event and for the ability to interact with each other, to communicate with each other globally, internationally, and to remember, you know, our practice is designed to bring us a happier life and to help us bring happiness to others. And this event should be dedicated to that end also. It seems to me that you know, any spirituality, any authentic spirituality, is meant to put us in touch with reality, not with fantasy. An authentic spiritual tradition, a spiritual tradition that is going to actually work, has to match the realities of the world, of life, of the cosmos, of how things are. And so, you know, this talk and two others that I'm proposing, if all goes well here, are meant to have us think a little bit about how our spiritual practice, our understanding of our practice, and our actual practice of our practice can match the reality of the world that we live in better. Because if it doesn't match the realities, then what good is it really? The purpose of a spiritual life isn't to substitute one set of fantasies for another. We're pretty good at living in fantasies without a spiritual life, and the spiritual life isn't just to substitute a new set of fantasies. So, how can we live our Buddhism? How can we live our spiritual life in more accordance with reality? So, you know, this is hard for us, I think. We're attached to illusions. This is a teaching of Buddhism, after all, that we suffer because we're attached to illusions. And illusions will not free us. Illusions will not save us. The truth shall set you free. But as Gloria Steinem said, the truth shall set you free, but first it might piss you off. Because we're attached to the illusions. And when our illusions are ripped away from us, we're not happy, usually. It's like having a Band-Aid taken off too fast, and it hurts. So so this is the first of three talks that are meant to, you know, put us in touch with the reality that we live in. And that reality is first and foremost global nowadays. And that'll be the talk today. To try to get us to detach from our attachments to old understandings of identity, of old understandings of who we are, that are no longer relevant, actually, in an internationally connected community. And so I'll talk more about that, obviously, today. This talk, as well as the other two that I'm proposing, might be upsetting a little bit to some people, and that's okay. The spiritual life is meant to be upsetting. Your spiritual life should be upsetting your apple cart. You know that expression? It should be upsetting your apple cart. It shouldn't be putting shock absorbers on your apple cart. you know, we're supposed to be freeing ourselves from all delusion, from all attachment, from all grasping. And so today I'll try to, you know, to point the way to how we can free ourselves from a certain kind of attachment in the context of a global community that we now all live in. Then I think I'd like to propose, you know, assuming that we have any success with this first one, that we do a second talk the first weekend in March, March 2nd and 3rd, and then a third talk on May 25th and 26th. So this talk will be about global Buddhism and how we can start thinking differently in light of the fact that cultural, national, religious boundaries are dissolving. Have dissolved, I would argue, have dissolved. And we just need to catch up with ourselves. It's no good to hold on to illusions of, you know, culturally bound forms of Buddhism in a global era. This is not realistic. This is not matching our spiritual practice to the reality, to one aspect of the reality that we live in. The second talk in March, I'd like to call Inclusive Buddhism. So today's Global Buddhism. Second talk will be Inclusive Buddhism. One of the tendencies that that people have, you know, individually and as groups, in the face of the breakdown of old ethnic, cultural, religious, national boundaries, is to circle the wagons. What's been called fundamentalism, really. This is the arise of fundamentalism, is explained as a reaction to a vastly new, open, you know, cultural situation, a religious situation. And some people find it, you know, so threatening that they become even more closed than they used to be. They become more closed in an open situation than they were in a closed situation. And we're in a vastly open situation. We're in a radically open situation. So inclusive Buddhism is against the illusion of a fundamentalist Buddhism. Fundamentalist Buddhism isn't a Buddhism at all, I would argue. And for reasons that we'll talk about today, actually. The very core of Buddhism mitigates against fundamentalism. It would seem impossible, actually, for there to be truly fundamentalist Buddhism. If Buddhism is, you know, has any real meaning, you know, historically and doctrinally, it precludes the idea of a fundamentalist closed version of Buddhism. So inclusive Buddhism and what that means, how can we be more open with our Buddhism and less closed? I've argued in person with some of you at some of the centers that these centers, there should not be insiders or outsiders. Nobody should be outsiders, you know? Everyone should be welcome, and nobody should be insiders. That whole dichotomy, insider-outsider, should be broken down so that everyone feels welcome, everyone feels like there's something in these centers for them that they can relate to, whether they're identified as Buddhists or not. So inclusive Buddhism also means how can we reach out to people who are not Buddhist and will never be Buddhist, people who are maybe not anything, who are non-affiliated whatsoever. This is one of the largest growing groups worldwide, is non-affiliated. In America, it is the single largest, fastest growing group when it comes to religious identification, people who refuse to be identified with any religion. It's now something like 25-30% of Americans. In Europe, religion, you know, is pretty much organized religion of the old sort is pretty much dead. There was an article recently published in, I think, in the London paper, suggesting that in 9 countries, religion is an endangered species. So inclusive Buddhism means a Buddhism that's going to include not just people who, you know, think that they're Buddhists or are interested in being Buddhist or something, but people who are interested in being nothing, who are non-affiliated, but still are interested in a spiritual life of living a good life. So more on that in March and then in May, what I'm calling practical Buddhism. How can we make Buddhism practical in our daily lives, which means that for those of us in, you know, Western countries, how can we make Buddhism not foreign, not exotic, but you know, indigenous to our own culture and to our own way of life? To keep Buddhism foreign and exotic is to keep it at arm's length. And in Asian countries, in Buddhist countries, where Buddhism is the indigenous religion, how can we make Buddhism not some artifact from the past, some historical artifact, not your mother and father's Buddhism, but a Buddhism that is relevant for us today? And in that talk, I'm just going to mention this quickly because I think it's so important. But in that talk, we'll explore more. I think there are three principles that we should follow to make, if Buddhism is going to be practical. There are three principles that have to be adhered to. I draw this from a podcast that I heard that I recommend highly. It's on iTunes under the Buddhist Geeks, I believe, the Buddhist Geeks series of podcasts. A podcast by a fellow named Hokal Sobol. Let me just check that. Hokai. Hokai Sobol, Sobol. He has a very, very insightful, I think, podcast called Upgrading to Post-Traditional Buddhism. Post-traditional, by post-traditional, he means post-limited, post-isolated and insular. So he's got three criteria that would count for a post-traditional Buddhism, and I think these are very, very important. Number one, can Buddhism be integrated into every part of our lives? And if not, what's the point exactly? To keep it segregated, to keep it sort of, differentiated from our economic lives, from our family lives, from our political lives, from our social lives. This is to keep it also ineffectual, isolated and ineffectual. The tiger should be let out of its cage. Keeping the tiger, a spiritual practice, as a tiger in a cage isn't going to change you, isn't going to really do much for you. To keep it sacred, as it were, okay? Because sacred means set apart. Sacred means differentiated from profane. Sacred means not ordinary. And Buddhism, if it's going to be effectual in our lives, must be very ordinary. So the second criterion is, can we explain to ourselves and to others Buddhism in ordinary language? And if we can't do that, then again, what exactly is the point? It's not really relevant. It's again being kept at arm's length. It's kept in a cage. It's kept safe from actually having to, change us. So if we can't speak about it in our own language, number one, then it's not really relevant. It's not really, been put into practical use. So this means translating the terms out of Sanskrit, out of Tibetan, and into our own language, into English, into Chinese, into French, whatever your language is, your ordinary language. And secondly, it means conceptually translating. So, instead of conceptual terms that are technical and that are, for insiders only, technical insider terms, emptiness, whatever it is, dependent origination, that these terms need to be translated into terms that anyone can understand. And that's the second criterion for practical Buddhism. A third criterion is, can we take responsibility for our practice? And not blame others, and not think that other people have control over our lives that they really don't. This means taking responsibility for your own life, for your own practice, and for your relationship with your teacher. Proper guru yoga. Guru yoga for the 21st century. Guru yoga for educated people who are independent, not dependent, who are not, infantilized, but who are adults. So that's in me. Practical Buddhism, how to make Buddhism practical. So the purpose of today's talk, Global Buddhism, is is to explore one of the components of our lives, of our lives as we lead them today. I'm going to argue that globalism isn't something that we should develop. It has developed. In other words, excuse me, this talk is primarily descriptive, not prescriptive. Descriptive. It's descriptive of a certain situation, of a certain part of our daily lives, which is that we are now all interconnected, as this event would indicate. You know, what is it, several decades ago, Marshall McLuhan, you know, coined this famous phrase, the medium is the message. And in a way, the fact that we're doing what we're doing now is the whole message, that we can do it. That we are living in an age of communication that was unthinkable not so long ago. In fact, in one generation, really, and things are changing at a very, very fast clip. When I was thinking about this talk, I was dwelling on the fact of how difficult it is for us to understand our own present. You know, sometimes it's been said that the past is a foreign country, but, you know, it's so different. But I would say the present is a foreign country also. It's hard to understand the time that you're living in. It's like fish who just can't see the water that they're swimming in, you know. So it's very difficult. And it's a very human, I think, tendency to lag behind, to be conservative. And to hold on to outworn ideas of themselves, of their own identity, of the world that they live in, and so forth, that don't match the realities anymore. So global Buddhism is a reality, actually. Globalism is a reality. Global Buddhism, there's two parts to it, okay? And I'll try to move through this kind of quickly in case we're having, you know, technical difficulties, and then assuming that all goes well, we can have a time to talk, to interact, between the centers here. But there's two parts to it, right? There's globalism, and there's the Buddhism part. So we'll start quickly with the globalism part. I mean, you know, just one more thing. If Buddhism isn't relevant to our present situation, which is, I will argue, global, then we should abandon it. There's no point to it. The whole point of a spiritual practice is that it's relevant, is that it's applicable to our own place and time. And so global Buddhism means a Buddhism that's adapted to globalism. And so I'll talk about globalism a little bit now, and then we'll talk about the Buddhism that and whether or not it's adaptable, you know, to globalism, whether or not it encourages adaptation or discourages it. And I bet you can guess which one I think it does. So anyway, what's globalism? In addition to, like, you know, the message, the medium is the message, you know, that we are participating, that we are right now enacting globalism. You know, how can we conceptualize it? So, I went to the internet, I looked up some, you know, some definitions of globalism. I just go through these kind of quickly. Globalism means an unprecedented level of internationalism, of cross-culturalism, and of communication, unprecedented in world history. Here's a couple of just phrases from definitions on globalism. The widening, deepening, and speeding up of global interconnection. The compression of the world, and the intensification of the consciousness of the world as a whole. The process of world shrinkage. That's kind of cool. Of distances getting shorter, things moving closer, the increasing ease with which somebody on one side of the world can interact to mutually benefit with somebody on the other side of the world, as we're doing right now. Hopefully, mutually benefiting. all those processes by which the peoples of the world are incorporated into a single world society. Another kind of definition. This one's from a very famous sociologist, Anthony Giddens, for those of you who know. He says, globalization can thus be defined as the intensification of worldwide social relations which link distant localities in such a way that local happenings are shaped by events occurring many miles away, and vice versa. That's globalism. That's the world that we live in. There are many dimensions to globalism. I won't go through them all. I'm not an expert in most of them. I'm not an expert in probably any of them. But geographical breakdown. People travel at an unprecedented rate nowadays. I read on the internet, somebody has figured out that at any given moment in time, like now, 500,000 people are in the air. 500,000 people are flying around from one place to another. And this has all happened in a generation. I remember my first airplane ride when I was a teenager. I was 15 years old, I believe. And getting on an airplane was a big deal. You know, it was expensive, it was rare, it was, you know, you dressed up for it, you know. And now it's just ordinary. We're, again, kind of sometimes don't realize the vast changes that have been wrought very, very quickly in our lives. The ability to just go, you know, vast distances. Geography has broken down. Geography has shrunk. So that, you know, that's one aspect of globalism. Economic globalism, again, I don't know that much about it, except for the fact that I do know that, you know, what happens in Greece, for example, has global implications. You know, the dollar in Australia is affected. You know, what happens in China, you know, affects what's going on in Singapore. What happens in the U.S. affects the whole world. You know, a global economy, actually. It's a global economy. Environmental, of course, the whole kind of crisis, actually, environmental crisis is a global one, not limited to any single nation and or culture. And what goes on, you know, sort of butterfly effect, you know, in all these dimensions, you know, what happens in one place affects the others. Political, you know, political globalization, you know, new unions are being formed in our lifetime. The European Union was formed in our lifetime. It's possible that other kinds of transnational, kind of configurations will occur. Linguistic breakdown, linguistic globalism, you could say. I read again in my research for this talk that, that 3.5 billion people on the planet, which is about exactly half, know some English. English is the international, you know, language, of course. You know, it's the largest, most popular second language in the world. There are now more, apparently, multilingual people in the world than monolingual people. More people in the world who know more than one language than people who only know one language. And the language that most everyone, you know, at least half of the globe knows is English. Partly because of, you know, what's coming. Because it's the language of the internet. So linguistic, and of course cultural globalism. Living in rural Australia, okay, first of all, you know, we can do this. But second of all, you know, if I get a hankering for Thai food, I can have it, Chinese food, I can have Greek food, all within, you know, driving distance. You know, here in cow land, there's cows just everywhere here, there's nothing. And yet, even in the smallest, little, dinkiest towns in, you know, country Victoria, we have access to, you know, to the world's cuisine. And let alone in places like, you know, Singapore, Los Angeles, you know, the Boston area and so forth, you know. Nashville also. Saskatoon also, you know. I'm not excluding these other places. You know, it's one world. It's one world culturally also, you know, in all kinds of ways. The sounds, the music that we listen to, the movies, much of the television, you know, is all global now. It's all the same. It's all becoming one culture. So, you know, that's just a little bit descriptive, actually, of the different aspects of globalism. The main engine of globalism is the internet. And you know, this is also in our lifetime, in one lifetime, the internet was invented. The World Wide Web was invented. There are people watching here, and I myself remember a time before the and we're the last generation who will remember that. And we, you know, maybe at some point in the next 10, 20 years, people will start interviewing people like me and other people of my age going like, you know, what was it like? What was it like before the internet? You know, how did you find out stuff? You know, how did you know anything about anything? You know, it's a miracle. It's a total miracle. And it has changed everything. And I think it has changed us in ways that we can't begin to fathom. We can't keep up with ourselves. We can't begin to fathom the way that our lives, our mentality, our way of thinking, our way of understanding, you know, the world around us has changed with the access to the World Wide Web. So this is not, of course, you know, I didn't just like, you know, think that up as the engine for globalism. Of course, this is kind of universally recognized that with the internet, you know, globalism has accelerated, you know, in unthinkable ways, you know, unpredictable ways, unthinkable ways. So just quickly, a couple of statistics, you know, it's kind of, I kind of find it amazing, you know, to look up stuff like this. You know, there are something like 6 billion mobile phone subscriptions in the world now. 6 billion. There's a population of 7 billion in the world. In other words, there's almost, you know, a cell phone for every human being on the planet. Of course, in some cases, there are more than one. And in some cases, there aren't any. But almost everyone has a cell phone. And with the cell phone, of course, you know, instant communication is possible. In the form of not just phone calls, but text messages. There are 200,000 text messages sent every second. Every second, globally. The cell phone owners in America, and I imagine that the statistics are somewhat the same in places like Australia, Singapore, Japan, you know, it's not just America, Canada. That cell phone owners between the ages of 18 and 24, so that's kids, exchange an average of 109 messages a day. A day. 110, 109.5 to be exact, you know, statistically. People are talking to each other all the time. People are communicating with each other all the time via the telephones and the text messages. Internet usage, there are now, so Rick, now's the time to put up that slide on worldwide access to the internet and usage in the internet if you can. I'm not seeing it here, but hopefully you guys are seeing it elsewhere. I'll talk about that.
Look.
Oh yeah, it's coming, huh?
You've got something, yeah.
Maybe it's happening. Internet usage statistics, the worldwide internet usage. From 2000 to 2009, the number of internet users globally rose from 360 million. This is in the course of 9 years, a decade. Rose from 360 million to 2.4 billion. In other words, now one in every three persons on the planet has access to the internet. In some countries, it's it's greater than others. Obviously, in some parts of the world, if you look at the column called penetration percentage of population, you'll see that in North America, nearly 80% of the population has access to the internet, which is the highest worldwide percentage wise. Europe 63.2%, Australia 67, Australia and Oceania 67.6%, and Asia only 27.5%. But then, if you look at the next column over to the left, internet users' latest data, you'll see that because of the population in Asia, they are by far the greatest number of people using the internet. Over a billion people in Asia have access and use of the internet, and these figures will only grow. Okay. So right now we're at about 34.3% of the population globally. But in countries, in parts of the world like Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America, Caribbean, you'll see if you look under growth, between 2000 and 2012. These are the places where the growth has been most dramatic. So although the actual penetration of the population is small, relatively, in those places, the growth is very, very large. 3,000% in Africa, 2,000%, you know, 2,600% in Middle East, 1,310% in Latin America growth over the course of a, you know, of a decade. And that will continue. So my point is this, when it comes to globalism and when it comes to the internet, is that, you know, this is a trend that isn't going to decrease. It's not going to decrease. Of course, we live in a global era where not everyone has the kind of unbelievable, you know, lives that we do and that many, many other people do. There are still, you know, 3 billion people on the world who live on $2.50 a day or less. 3 billion, nearly half. And, you know, they're not surfing the World Wide Web. But we are. Couple billions of us are living that kind of life, and the trend will be for more and more of us on the globe, in the globe, around the world, to participate in this globalism. Just a couple more, because I, you know, it's kind of interesting. There are 1 billion Google searches every day going on now. 1 billion. There are 3.14 billion email accounts worldwide. Nearly half the population has an email account. 2 billion videos are viewed daily on YouTube. 2 billion. The total number of videos on YouTube is estimated now at 1 trillion. 1 trillion, you know, videos. 48 hours of new video are being uploaded every minute to YouTube. There are 550 million websites on the World Wide Web. 550 million. There are 500,000 people with Twitter accounts. And then Facebook has just passed over a billion, right? 1 billion people on Facebook. And then if you include the other social networks, 2.4 billion are using one form or another of the social networks online. This is the world that we live in, okay? Globalism is, you know, is a fact. It's a reality. And so, you know, the next thing is, you know, well, then what is global Buddhism? What's the Buddhism part? And so when we were advertising this, you know, this event, you know, global Buddhism. Someone anonymously emailed me and said, are you creating a new religion? And this was right before my retreat, so I had all of retreat to think about that email, actually. And I became more and more flummoxed about how to even begin to answer that question. Since it was anonymous, I couldn't answer it anyway. But maybe the person who wrote it is, you know, is tuning in here. Are you creating a new religion by advertising a talk on global Buddhism, the components of global Buddhism? And so, you know, I did get to think about that quite a bit. First of all, there are no new religions. Every religion is based on another religion. Okay, right? If you look at the history of religions, every religion is founded on the basis of a previous religion. Christianity was founded on Judaism. Islam was founded on Christianity and Judaism. Buddhism was founded on ancient Indian religion. There are no religions that are new. So at one level you could say, how could I form a new religion? You know, even if I, you know, were a kind of a genius, which I'm not, and like, you know, could like even begin to like, you know, think about forming a new religion? It's impossible. No religions are new. Okay? Secondly, are you forming a new religion? If it's not new, you know, if religion isn't keeping up, if it isn't changing, then what's the point of it, you see? Like, the implication was you shouldn't somehow create a new religion. But I would put the shoe on the other foot and say, if you're not creating a new religion in your life, if you're not creating a religion that's alive, that's changing, that's innovating with the changing times, then you're hanging on to a fossil. You're hanging on to an irrelevant fossil. And so, you know, from another point of view, you could say that, you know, there's no religion that isn't new and isn't constantly adapting. This is descriptive, actually. The living religions are always new, and it's prescriptive, and they should be, because if they're not new, if they're not keeping up, then they're irrelevant, actually. They're irrelevant to our lives. So, you know, many of you, I think, have heard me say, you know, kind of jokingly in teachings that, you know, when we're talking spiritual teacher doesn't have news, you know, just olds. And that's true in a way. But it's also true that the olds have to be constantly be put into new frameworks, into new contexts. They have to change. They have to adapt. I think in the New Testament, the image was putting new wine into old skins. New wine into old skins, or old wine into new skins? Now I forgot, but you know what I mean. And the new context for the olds.
Must be old wine into new skins.
Old wines into new skins. I think know, so. I don't know. Anyway. You get the point. It doesn't really matter. The point is that if religion, Buddhism very much included, isn't changing, isn't adapting, isn't being adjusted to new contexts, then it's dead. It's irrelevant. And of course, this is a religion that has always done this. So just a brief history lesson, and then I want to turn, you know, for the rest of the talk to what Buddhism really teaches, and whether it teaches that, you know, you shouldn't adapt Buddhism or you shouldn't change Buddhism or something like that. So a little history lesson first. There is no Buddhism that can be or has ever been divorced from its cultural context. Every form of Buddhism has always been thoroughly integrated into whatever culture it's found itself in. India, of course. So the Buddhism arose in ancient India in the context of, you know, religions like Jainism, religions like Hinduism, nascent Hinduism, ancient Indian religions, and was that form of Buddhism? Was that cultural form of Buddhism? Ancient Indian cultural form of Buddhism? And there's no Buddhism that isn't like that. Okay, when Buddhism went to China, it took on the cultural trappings of China, of the Chinese culture. When it went to Japan, similarly, Korea, Southeast Asia, everywhere that Buddhism has gone from the from the very start, Buddhism has been encoded within a cultural context. There is no possibility of a Buddhism that isn't integrated into its context. There's no contextualist Buddhism, okay, like that. So it's not a matter of, like, you know, what's the Buddhism that lies outside of a context. There's no possibility of that. There's no possibility of recovering that. There's no possibility of that existing. Never mind recovering. It's never existed. Buddhism has always been integrated into its cultural and historical context. So, what's the cultural and historical context that Buddhism is being integrated into now? And again, it's not a particular culture. It's not, you know, India. It's not China. It's not Thailand. It's not Japan. It's not Korea. And it's not just, you know, Europe or America either. So, you know, some people say, oh, well, you know, the new form of Buddhism is Western Buddhism. But I would argue that Western Buddhism is also anachronistic conceptualization, identification. That the only form of Buddhism that there is nowadays is in a global context. And we'll talk more about that in March, a little bit more about that in March. But, you know, pay attention to what's going on around you. You know, look at what the Dalai Lama is doing, for example. Is the Dalai Lama really teaching Tibetan Buddhism? At least in the old understanding of Tibetan Buddhism, he's been influenced by the global context. He's been influenced by other religions. The influence of Christianity, for example, on the Dalai Lama and on people like Thich Nhat Hanh, who are arguing for engaged Buddhism, that came from the interaction with Christianity. There's no isolated Buddhisms anymore. Every form of Buddhism knows, number one, about every other form of Buddhism. Okay, so Theravada Buddhism knows about Mahayana Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism knows about Japanese Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism knows about Western Buddhism, and so forth. The idea of culturally isolated, insular forms of Buddhism is outdated. All forms of Buddhism now are global Buddhism. All forms of Buddhism are interacting with each other and influence each other, number one. Number two, they are interacting and being influenced by and influencing the other religions of the world. They're all the religions of the world are, you know, interacting with one another also. And, you know, for example, the rise of interest in many forms of Christianity in meditation is a Buddhist influence on Christianity. Just like Christianity has influenced Buddhism, Buddhism has influenced Christianity. And everyone's influencing everyone else. So, and then thirdly, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there's vast numbers of people, especially in the developing world, who are non-identified with any religion and are not interested in identifying with any religion. And so, this is also a force. Secularism is an influence on religion as well. And the science, secular, and other forms of secular ideologies and so forth, are also now in the mix when it comes to the global context for Buddhism. So here's the bottom line on that, and then we'll move into a proper Buddhist teaching maybe on what Buddhism is instead of some random intellectual thing on globalism. But here's the bottom line, okay? That there's no point in searching for or claiming to have access to an authentic Buddhism, if authentic means a Buddhism that hasn't been encoded into and influenced by, conditioned by, its cultural situation. There's no point. There's no authenticity doesn't mean that in Buddhism. It can't mean that because there's no form of Buddhism that would be authentic. It means isolated from its cultural conditioning. Or from its historical conditioning, for that matter, either. There's no possibility of recovering an original Buddhism. There never was an original Buddhism. Okay, no. So what do I mean by that? Number one, the Buddhism that the Buddha taught is basically inaccessible to us. All we have is later records, later historical records. What the actual Buddhism was, that Buddhism was, first of all, it wasn't Buddhism, of course, right? Because the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. So original Buddhism is an impossibility. It can't be accessed historically, and it's an impossibility because it wasn't Buddhism. You see what I mean? It wasn't institutionalized as an ism. It was the Buddha teaching what he thought was true, what would help, what would work. So, and then there's another sort of dimension of that, because people are, kind of like keen on this. They're like, no, our Buddhism should be authentic in the sense of, maybe original, more original somehow. So number one, or maybe sort of divorced, isolated from any kind of particular culture or particular time. And this is just impossible. So it's impossible for the reasons that I talked about. The original Buddhism is inaccessible to us. It wasn't Buddhism anyway, originally. And the idea that, or even the idea that an original Buddhism, 2,500-year-old, Buddhism, even if it were recoverable, would mean an irrelevant Buddhism. A Buddhism that, was relevant for somebody 2,500 years ago and didn't change. didn't adapt, didn't make adjustments as it went through time and as it came to different places. And so what's the point of like arguing for that? I will suggest that the only authenticity that's really relevant when it comes to, you know, gauging, you know, a spiritual practice is, does it work? Does it help? Does it bring people to happiness? Does it help people alleviate their suffering? And then it's authentic. And that, I think, is what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught a useful Buddhism, a Buddhism that was utilitarian. And if it worked, great. And if it didn't, let's leave it, you see? And I suggest that that's a Buddhism for a global context as well. Does it help? Does it help us adjust? Does it help us live better lives in the situation that we find ourselves in? Culturally, you know, globally, religiously, does it help? And in a global context, hanging on to ideas of isolated, insular, culturally bound forms of Buddhism is not helpful. Global Buddhism. Global Buddhism is a fact, and global Buddhism is supported, I would suggest, by what we might call the core. So although Buddhism has never been divorced, can be divorced from its cultural and historical context, we can, I think, find some genetic, you know, kind of core that you know, is then embellished or, you know, kind of interpreted in different ways in different places at different times. So the rest of the talk, I'd like to just kind of outline what I think that core is, and see whether or not it is helpful to us living in a global context, or whether or not it encourages us to adapt our practice to new contexts, or whether it prohibits that. And I think we'll see that Buddhism at its core has always been acknowledging that if it doesn't change, if it doesn't adapt, then it's not Buddhism. You see, a Buddhism that doesn't change is a contradiction in terms, according to Buddhism itself. So I think we have a series of slides now that we'll go through, and then we'll end with a kind of a summary of all of the components of all of those slides that I believe you have as a hard copy handout in each of your centers. So Rick, if you want, please put up the first slide, which is you know, when people, you know, when people are asked, when people have to say, what do you think is the core form of Buddhism, the core of Buddhism, what's the genetic, you know, kind of underlying structure of Buddhism, they often say, well, it's the three lakshanas, tri lakshana, the three characteristics. This is, I don't know if you can see this, hopefully you can. This is the cover of the Kensei Norbu book, Dzongsar Jamyen Kensei. Very, very popular book that came out a couple of years ago, What Makes You Not a Buddhist? What Makes You Not a Buddhist? And, you know, he says, you're not a Buddhist, you're not precluded from being a Buddhist by, you know, any nationality, any cultural group. You're not precluded from being a Buddhist if you're, not a vegetarian, or if you are a vegetarian, you know. It's not about that. It's not about any of that. What it's about is, do you adhere to the lakshanas, to the three characteristics or not? And this, so, you know, this is just one of many Buddhist thinkers that have identified the core of Buddhism as this structure, the structure of these three lakshanas. Lakshana means, in Sanskrit, lakshana means a defining characteristic, actually. It means something that marks, signs that mark, you know, the very essence of a thing, the thing that makes the thing itself, okay? The thing that makes it. So the three lakshanas are, you know, first, are the first level, I think you can say, of the structure of Buddhism. So what are the three lakshanas? Number one, impermanence. Anicca. Anicca. Do we have that slide up again? Yeah, there it is. Yeah, thanks. Anicca means things change. the full long-playing, dance version of this lakshana, of this sign, is that all things dependent on causes and conditions are impermanent. And, some of you Buddha heads out there who've, studied Buddhism know that there are only like two or three things that aren't, dependent on causes and conditions. One of them is empty space, okay? Empty space is permanent. And, but nobody like really suffers because they mistake empty space for being an impermanent thing when it's a permanent thing. That's so big deal, And then emptiness itself, what they call emptiness, shunyata, emptiness itself is also a permanent factor in the sense that it's not constantly changing and it's not dependent on causes and conditions. But everything else, okay? Everything else, your car, your job, your relationships, everything is changing. That is the fundamental teaching of Buddhism, that things change, including, of course, Buddhism itself. You see, if it's fundamental teaching to Buddhism that things that are dependent on causes and conditions will change, then of course Buddhism, by definition, acknowledges its own changing status. Okay, number one. Number two, the absence of defining essences. This is what's called anatman. This is my best translation of this. I'd like to seriously work more on a translation of anatman that kind of puts it into ordinary language. No self, I think, is very, very, confusing. That's kind of one of the usual translations of anatman. So I'm giving it a go here. The absence of defining essences means that nothing has an essential quality from its own side that defines it. The pen is not a pen from its own side. It's a pen because of the consensus of people who call it a pen. It's not a pen. There's no defining essence of it as a pen. And that also is true about everything. There's no defining essence to anything in life, including ourselves, including our understanding of ourselves. We exist as a conceptualization, a nominal conceptualization on the basis of constantly changing parts. Okay? And that's also true of Buddhism. Okay, so in the structure of Buddhism itself, there's the understanding that Buddhism itself has no essential structure. That is the structure of Buddhism, that it has no essential structure, that it has no defining essence. Okay, so you could say that Buddhism sort of implodes upon itself. It defines itself as being something that cannot be defined. As something that can't be pinned like a butterfly, a constantly changing thing with an understanding of it, with a definition of it that is purely nominal, that is purely an idea, a concept, a name that we apply to it. And so again, for our kind of thinking about global Buddhism, global Buddhism is a name. Global Buddhism is a concept. And does our concept of Buddhism help us live in the reality that we're living, a global reality? So if we're conceptualizing Buddhism in a kind of an old school way, in an insular way, in an isolated way, in a culturally bounded way, and so forth, then maybe it's not a very, very useful, relevant, helpful conceptualization. So Buddhism does exist. It's not that Buddhism doesn't exist because it's impermanent or because it doesn't have a defining essence in it. It does exist, but it exists like everything else, nominally, conceptually, as an idea. And the question is whether or not our old ideas of Buddhism, culturally bounded Buddhism, are useful anymore, or whether we should reconceptualize Buddhism, in terms of the global context. The third characteristic is dukkha. in Sanskrit, dukkha. Dukkha means suffering. And suffering primarily here means the suffering that comes from thinking that impermanent things are permanent and thinking that things that have no self do, have no defining essence do. And we suffer because of that. That's the most fundamental core of Buddhism right there. Everything is impermanent. Everything is without a defining essence in and of itself. And if you don't understand that, you will suffer. Okay, that's the barest bones. Then, of course, the third lakshana repositions itself as the first of what are called the Four Noble Truths, Four Arya Truths. So, Rick, you can put up the second slide now. So you see that, you know, in the, or maybe you're seeing, we're not seeing it here yet, that underneath the third lakshana, the third characteristic, we can position the four truths, the four Arya truths. So, you know, we're now kind of filling out the bare bones structure, the genetic code of Buddhism. And the first noble truth sort of restates the third lakshana, that life is suffering. You know, you remember that phrase that they used, I forget which space event it was, where they radioed down to Houston and said, "Houston, we have a problem. The spacecraft doesn't work anymore," or something, whatever it was. You see, the recognition of a problem, the recognition of suffering is the first truth. You have to recognize that we are suffering for you to do anything about it, for you to get motivated to do anything about it. So that's the first. "Houston, we have a problem" is the first truth. And that is a truth. That's a universal truth. That without, you know, doing something about it, without making efforts spiritually, we will definitely suffer. The second one is that suffering has a cause. And the cause of suffering in Buddhism, as well as in every major world religion, is none other than ourselves. It's not somebody else's fault that we're suffering. It's not somebody else's responsibility to do something about it. That the cause of suffering is our own actions, or lack thereof, our misunderstandings of things, or whatever. That the cause of suffering is our own responsibility. So that's the second truth. And, you know, again, we're kind of just outlining the bare bones here. The third truth is that there's an alternative. In Buddhism, we call it nirvana or Buddhahood. But there's an alternative to suffering. It doesn't have to be this way. That the suffering nature of life is solvable. That there's an alternative. And, you know, again, I think, you know, it's not just in Buddhism that there is this understanding.
You all right?
Yeah, I'm all right. It looks like there's a message here that Rena's having a problem. But we'll keep going.
Yep.
That there's an alternative to suffering is the third one. And you know, all authentic religious traditions offer an alternative to suffering. This is not, you know, kind of unique to Buddhism, but Buddhism, of course, does too. And then the fourth one is the method, that there's something that we can do about it. And I would put it like this, okay? You know, in terms of bare bones Buddhism for the 21st century, what works? What works? What has utility? What has usefulness in terms of bringing us out of suffering? And so now, yeah, go ahead, Rick, you can put that third slide up, because then the next part is to kind of unfold a little bit the cause of suffering in the fourfold truths. And you know, there are different understandings of the cause of suffering in different texts. In the Mahayana texts, they tend to identify ignorance as the cause of suffering. But in the older texts of the Pali tradition, they're pretty much unanimous that the cause of suffering is what they call tanha in Pali, or tirshna in Sanskrit. It means craving. And craving then leads to grasping, upadana, grasping, and so these reform also, for those of you who who've studied, as the eighth and ninth links of the chain of dependent origination. So many people, not just in the Theravada older Pali oriented forms of Buddhism, but also in the Mahayana forms of Buddhism, all forms of Buddhism, tend to point to these as the primary links that need to be broken if the chain of suffering is going to be broken. So the cause of our suffering is craving, trishna, and grasping. And then in the text they break down the grasping into four sorts. Craving and grasping go together. Craving means I want, and grasping means I really, really want. It's an intensified form of craving. And so the four forms of grasping are listed here in this handout. Grasping to objects of sensual desire. And we're all familiar with that. You know, grasping to our iPods, grasping to our, you know, nights out on the town, to the delicious Thai meal. You know, grasping to keeping our senses, pleasured. And we suffer as a result of that grasping. The second one is grasping to rules and regulations. Sila vrata is in the Sanskrit. Sila is the same word that they use for morality. In like the six perfections, the second perfection is sila. So sila vrata. Vrata means vow. So one sila vrata is usually understood as meaning rules and regulations. Rules and regulations. Grasping to rules and regulations. And this doesn't mean that we shouldn't have rules and regulations. Okay? It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be guided by morality and by vowed behavior and by, you know, following the rules that would bring us a better life. But it also means that we shouldn't grasp to those rules in a fundamentalist kind of a way. And that's inherent in the very structure, the very core of Buddhism itself. And then there are other ones here that will sort of further underline that. Grasping to a belief in defining essences. Atmavada. Atma means the self. Vada means the philosophy. So grasping to the philosophy that things have some kind of authentic essence. You see? Have some kind of unchanging, unchangeable, authentic, defining essence is one of the four forms of grasping that keeps us suffering. So once again, the point. Inherent in Buddhism itself, in the structure of Buddhism, is the doctrine that we shouldn't be grasping to doctrines, that we shouldn't be grasping to ideas about Buddhism as unchanging or as non-adaptable to different contexts and so forth. Okay? Atmavada, the philosophy that things shouldn't change, that things have some kind of essence. And then the last one's kind of interesting, grasping to worldviews. Drishti. And, sometimes you read, in explanations of this, it means grasping to wrong worldviews, they say. But actually, the Sanskrit doesn't say that. The Sanskrit says grasping to any worldview. Drishti just means any worldview. And that understanding that's a form of grasping, that's one of the main four forms of grasping, that grasping to any worldview, that understanding is also legitimated in Nagarjuna, who says much the same kind of thing in much the same kind of language, that if you grasp to any worldview, including the worldview of Buddhism itself, you see, that grasping to it will cause suffering eventually. So what does it mean to grasp to a worldview? What does it mean? It means grasping to it as if it weren't changing, as if it were unchangeable, as if it had some kind of authentic, pure essence that it doesn't have, you see. And so within the structure of Buddhism itself is warnings about a misunderstanding of Buddhism that will cause more suffering, not less. And that's fueled by grasping itself, you see. But upadana actually does, in Sanskrit, it's kind of interesting. It has a connotation of fuel. the very word that that's translated here as grasping, upadana, can also mean fuel. It adds fuel to the fire. You see, it's like that. Adds fuel to the fire of suffering. So we'll fill out the chart with the last one now. The fourth of the handouts, Rick, on the structure of Buddhism, which I think you guys all have as part of your printed out handouts. So this just fills out the method. So we have under the method the three higher trainings. Adi Shiksha. You know, there are many different kinds of methods in Buddhism. You know, one understanding of the method is the Eightfold Path in the early Pali texts. Another understanding of the method is, the six perfections in the Mahayana tradition. There are many understandings of, you know, what's going to work to bring us out of suffering and into happiness. And you can put it now, since we've kind of unfolded things a little bit, what's going to work to help us stop grasping, stop the craving and grasping that is the cause of our suffering, and deliver us to the state of nirvana, of happiness, which, you know, just to sort of spell that out a little bit, if the cause of suffering is craving, is discontentment and grasping, then nirvana would be the opposite of that. Nirvana would be a state of complete contentment and of complete freedom, you see, freedom from grasping. Freedom from grasping to impermanent things as if they were permanent, and grasping to things that have no essences to them as if they did. So the opposite of grasping is nirvana. The opposite of craving and grasping is nirvana. Now, how can we get there? What's the method that would bring us there? And so again, as a kind of an attempt to put together a skeletal form of the Buddhist teachings that would apply to any particular cultural iteration of Buddhism, Tibetan, Chinese, Southeast Asian, or whatever, the three higher trainings is universal to all Buddhist teachings. Ethics, Shila, ethics, Samadhi, which I've translated here as meditative integration, which I'll come back to, and wisdom. And so the Eight Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, rather, is subdivided into these three. These three are found in Mahayana texts also as the three higher trainings. The Adi means above and beyond, okay, transcendent, like Adi Shiksha. So the most general categories of the method, you could say, the most general categories of any method. So this whole concept of Adi Shiksha implies the idea that lots of different things could be fitted under these three great divisions, these great three great classes. But these are the three great ones. So ethics, number one, we'll start with ethics. And, there's all kinds of ethical, training. There's all kinds of different ethical codes. There's the, Vinaya code for the, monks and nuns. There's the householder code. There's the, five precepts. There's all kinds of codes, ethical codes. But the essence of all ethics comes down to two things. Ahimsa, not harming others, and compassion. Karuna, helping, not harming, and helping. I remember hearing the Dalai Lama in a podcast say that if somebody asks you, what's the essence of Buddhism, you could tell them not harming and dependent origination. Not harming, and everything depends on something else. Nothing has any kind of intrinsic, essence to it. And because things are dependent, they're changing. Okay, so he's saying that would be the one sort of shorthand version of, what Buddhism is. So, ethics. Ethics helps us to stop grasping to self and selfishness. Ahimsa means not just following your untrained instincts, not just following your selfish, kind of almost hardwired selfishness to just get what you want at whatever expense, you see, at whatever expense, other people have to go through for what you want. So you're restraining yourself. You're restraining yourself from that kind of selfishness, from that kind of grasping, that kind of craving, you see, that kind of, what do I want, you know, and you better get out of my way. And then karuna, compassion, means training yourself to think about others and not yourself, you see. To learn how to detach from selfishness and from the idea that our sense of self, is there, is a reality, and that we should just, kind of follow whatever our selfish desires, would be. So that's the ethics. Meditative integration is the attempt to translate samadhi. I thought a lot about it and continue to think about it. It's the second of the three main classes of things that will work for bringing us to happiness. And so samadhi means integrating your mind with an object. One-pointed concentration, similar to shamatha, to the idea of shamatha. But I think it means more than that. I think it means ultimately integrating yourself with reality, integrating your mind with the reality that you live in. And that's the goal. The goal of samadhi is full samadhi, complete samadhi, is full integration into life. Into reality and away from illusion, of course. So to disintegrate, detach from illusion and fantasy, and to integrate fully into reality, samadhi, and through the developing of your mind. Okay, so that's the second method, and then the third is wisdom. And wisdom is kind of like all of the above. Wisdom's understanding that this is the structure. This is the structure of Buddhism, but Buddhism is trying. The structure of Buddhism is the structure of reality, that things are impermanent, that things have no defining essences to them, and misunderstanding that is the cause of our suffering. Misunderstanding that, and because we misunderstand that, we grasp, we cling to things as if they weren't changing. And to things as if they had some kind of, essential, definitive nature to them, essence to them, including, of course, Buddhism itself. Okay? So that's the bare-bones structure of Buddhism, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit, if you want. My point is just that if you look at it, if you look at what Buddhism actually is teaching, Buddhism is teaching that any form of Buddhism that isn't changing, that isn't adapting, that isn't relevant, continually made relevant to the context in which people actually live, is not Buddhism at all. It's not Buddhism at all. So it's a kind of an interesting paradox that the only definition of Buddhism is that it has no solid definition. That the only authentic Buddhism is a Buddhism that's constantly in flux, that's constantly repositioning, to help people. So again, bottom line here is that the authenticity of Buddhism, like the authenticity of any spiritual tradition, is it useful? Does it help? Does it help us alleviate our suffering? Does it help us lessen our grasp, lessen our craving, lessen our grasp on things? Or does it move us towards more grasping, you see? And if it leads us to more grasping, then it isn't really Buddhism, you see? If it leads us to more grasping to Buddhism, it isn't really Buddhism. So last thing, okay? Because I'm trying to learn Pali. And so I found a Pali text, and I actually gave it a go, translating it. This is called the Gautami Sutta. Gautami is not Gautama; it's a woman that asked Buddha you know, what's the criterion? What's the criteria for, you know, for determining whether it's Dharma, whether it's truth, whether it's Buddha Dharma? And here's what he said. Gautami, you should know this when it comes to any teaching. So the word here is Dhamma. Dhamma in Pali, Dharma in Sanskrit. You should know this. Do these teachings lead to detachment or to greed? See, if it's to detachment, then it's Dharma. If it leads to greed, it's not Dharma. Does it decrease or increase the causes for your suffering? Does it decrease the causes or increase the causes? If it decreases them, it's Dharma. If it increases them, it's not Dharma. Does it bring you to being satisfied with what you have? Or does it lead to always wanting more? If it's the former, it's Dharma. If it's the latter, not Dharma. Does it lead to humility? Or does it lead to pride? If it leads you to humility, it's truth. It's the Dharma. If it leads to more pride, oh, I'm a Buddhist and you're not. Yeah. Or I'm a better Buddhist than your form of Buddhist. You see? Yeah, it's not Dharma at all. It's not Buddhism at all. Does it lead to contentment? The word is in Pali is santuti. Santuti. Guess what that is in Sanskrit?
Mm-hmm.
Santosha. Does it lead to contentment or to discontentment? With your life, you see? With life as it is. Contentment or discontentment? Does it lead to learning how to be happy on your own? Or does it lead to feeling more needy when it comes to relationships? That's an interesting one, too. Does it lead to feeling self-contained? You know, independent in that sense. And therefore, you know, able to help other people, of course. You know, because you're not a helpee. You're okay. You're fixed. You don't need from other people. Does it lead to that state? Or does it lead to further neediness? Does it lead to the state of being a helpee all the time? Does it lead to being able to exert more energy? Virya. Does it lead to more virya, enthusiastic effort? Or does it lead to laziness? Does it lead to torpor? Does it lead to being independent? Or does it lead to being a burden on others? And then he says at the end, he says, you know, Gautami, you may be certain that you may certainly take these teachings up, knowing that this is Dharma. You know, the first of those pairs. You can take those teachings if it is useful in bringing about those ends. You can know, says the Buddha, that it's Dhamma, it's Dharma, that it's Vinaya, that it's the true code, ethical code, and that it is the teacher's instruction. That it is the teaching of the teacher, the Buddha, and so that's where I'd like to end. Does it work? Does the Dharma that we are learning, that we are practicing, that we are teaching others, does it bring about those kinds of an effects? Does it alleviate suffering? Or does it cause more? Does it lessen our grasp on things as if they weren't impermanent, changing all the time and without essences? Or does it further our grasp on that? And that's the gauge as to whether it's Dharma or not. Does it lead to a happier life in the context of the life that we lead? And in this context, and in this time, in this day and age, that context, as I've suggested, is global, and not insular, not provincial, not parochial, but global. So that's all I have to say about global Buddhism, and then maybe some of these issues will unfold a little bit more, unpack a little bit more in the next talk on inclusive Buddhism. So at this point, maybe we can try the interactive deal and see how that goes.
Maybe you can do one center per center. Oh, look. There's LA.
We're seeing LA, LA right now.
Hi. Everyone's waving to you.
Rick, we can't hear you if you're saying anything.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. There's a little delay. What I'll do is I think in order, since when everyone was on, Cindy kept popping off. By the way, you sounded really great the whole time, pretty much. You know, every once in a while, a little chip-chop, and then you'd come right back again. So
could have been the rain.
You know, we're very sweet on this end. I think the only casualty is Nashville's location was tricky. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to type really quick. Why don't we start close by? Maybe it'll seem like it's closer connected. Marie, do you guys have a question? If you type it in and turn on your stream, and you can ask Mamaji a question.
Okay, so she's going to be typing it in on the public chat thing. Is that right, Rip?
I think she's going to say whether she's...
She's just going to tell me if you're ready with a question, and then I'll turn them on. I just don't want to don't have one. Hold on one second. If I turn everyone on, I'm afraid you might get knocked off again. How about this? Anyone else who can hear, go ahead. If you have a question, just type in the chat thing and I'll turn your window on. Otherwise, I'll go around. I'll pick on you.
We're coming.
Yeah. I'll go around, Rob. Or Lama Maru can pick on a center. Pick a center out of a hat, Lama.
I'm looking at the public chat and it looks like Singapore has a question. Says Chuck and Angie. So maybe you can put Singapore on.
Coming at you, and I will turn my audio off, but I'll stay on. Hello.
There's the Singapore group. Good to see you all. Chuck, I can't hear you. Sorry, I can't hear Chuck at all.
Yeah, a little bit.
Just a little bit. It sounds like you're like miles away from your microphone.
Maybe Chuck can type his
I have to type it, Chuck. Wanting more teachings, is that grasping? yeah, I mean, of course it is. The idea, how to put this, there's good grasping and bad grasping, right? I mean, there's helpful grasping in a way. There's grasping that's helpful on the way to non-grasping, and so we grasp to ideas, to concepts, to teachings, to practices that are helpful, and try to let go of the ones that aren't helpful. But that's not the end. You see, the end is freedom. The end is nirvana. And that means freedom from all forms of grasping, including grasping, of course, to teachings. And here's, I think, here's a way to, for some of us, you see, I think some of us need to grasp to more teachings, especially in the, you know, the early stages of your Dharma career, of your spiritual life. You should be grasping to as many teachings, useful teachings as possible. But I think that there also comes a point where it's important to try to realize that you've probably had enough teachings, you know, that it's not like at a certain point you're going to hear anything dramatically different or new about how to live a good life, you know? And the grasping to teachings then just becomes a way to avoid having to put the teachings that you already have had into practice in your life. So, you see, it's a little bit of a tightrope. We have to take teachings. We have to, you know, go to our teachers. We have to study our scriptures. You know, we have to grasp in that sense in order to make progress. But there also is this kind of tendency that we all have, I think, to, you know, to just be kind of thinking that by endlessly going to teachings, that is Dharma. That is my practice. That my practice is just going to teachings. Your practice is to go to teachings and then put the teachings into effect. And if the practice is just going to teachings all the time, then that's a form of grasping to teachings that's not helpful. That's a kind of a diversionary tactic so that you don't actually have to change your life. See? All you have to do is keep showing up to teachings and think, well, that's sufficient. You see what I mean? Well, I'm seeing Chuck, but I'm not hearing anything from him, and I'm not seeing anything in the public chat room. Oh, is that Nashville? No. Is it? Where is that?
Yeah.
Nashville? Not sure. No, Reno.
Reno, maybe. They've got that blue wall.
So I'm not sure if there's any more questions or not. Rick, I'm not seeing anything, hearing anything. Turn your mic and ask a question. Is that Marie? Looks like Marie. If we are to be part of global Buddhism, this is from Australia, Marie Fowler. If we are to be part of global Buddhism at one level, is it true that we have to necessarily engage in many of the cultural items of the local community in which we live? Yeah, of course. You know, what's that phrase? You know, think globally, act locally. You know, of course, we interact with the people that are in our vicinity, are in our immediate purview, geographically, physically. But, of course, we're also interacting all the time with people, all over the place. At least I am, and I think many people, perhaps most of the people who are involved in this event here, you know, are emailing, are texting, are visiting people's Facebooks all the time also. So the interaction, you know, is occurring on a global level as well as on a, on a local physical level, you know, kind of both, at all times for us nowadays. And so, you know, this isn't to preclude, you know, physical contact with people actually, you know, in your world, but it's to just recognize that that's not the only kind of contact that we have anymore. And it didn't used to be that way. And so the days of yore, where contact was only of that sort of kind of personal, immediate, physical kind, then I would suggest that Buddhism had one kind of understanding of Buddhism. It's a context, one kind of context that Buddhism, you know, worked in, fitted in, adapted to, and so forth. But our context is different, and our understanding of Buddhism also has to be different. So, for example, I mean, what I mean by that is that a culturally bounded, a culturally insular, a culturally isolated form of Buddhism was a Buddhism that was appropriate to a culturally isolated culture. And that was the culture of many, you know, most, I would say, historically, forms of Buddhism. It was in a context of a very, very limited, delimited, you know, understanding of the world, a very closed understanding of the world. And that's not the context that that Buddhism finds itself in now. It's not the context that any of us live in now. There's a bunch of things coming in on the chat. Let me change. The components of a daily practice doesn't, I don't think, need to change to adjust to a global Buddhism. I would say more the components of daily thought. How's that? That it's mostly mental, I think. It's recognition, number one. It's recognition of the case. It's recognition of the facts of life, that we are living in a global context. And then secondly, to get our minds and our concepts, our categories, to catch up with that, including our understanding of Buddhism, very much including our understanding of the Buddhism that we're practicing. That we're practicing a Buddhism in a global context. And that's the reality of it. And to kind of catch up with that, instead of like hanging on to anachronistic. You know what anachronistic means? Doesn't fit the time. Anachronistic ideas about a closed Buddhism, you know, doctrinally closed, dogmatically closed, culturally closed. Oh my, I'm Tibetan Buddhist, you're Chinese Buddhist, or you're Western Buddhist. Or we're all global Buddhists. Which doesn't also mean that there isn't, I think, a place for the practice of, you know, what's called Tibetan Buddhism, for example, or South, you know, Southeast Asian Buddhism. Doesn't mean that at all. But it means an understanding that the practice of Tibetan Buddhism is in a global context. Okay? It's in a global context. Tibetan Buddhism has been affected by the global context no less than anything else, you see. So we'll go into that a little bit more, I think, in March. That, you know, it's an anachronistic idea, which grasping to an idea that any of these forms of Buddhism available to us haven't been affected by the interactions that they've all undergone as the world has opened up, as the world has become one. We are all citizens of the world, and there's nobody isolated. I remember reading in graduate school a long time ago, okay? So reading a memoir by the great anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss. It was called Tristes Tropiques in the original French. And it was an account of his graduate school days when he went as a graduate student in anthropology to, you know, deepest, darkest Brazil, you know, some up the Amazon River or something like that, to try to find a tribe, you know, reputed to exist that was completely isolated, that was completely unknown, undiscovered. And he found the tribe, and he found that they were using as a stove, as a cooking device, a Campbell soup can. You see, nobody's been untouched. No undiscovered people. That was, what, I don't know, 50, 75 years ago now. Let alone now in the age of the World Wide Web. Nobody's undiscovered. Nobody's uninfluenced by anyone else. Nobody is pure in that sense, as if that was a, you know, desideratum anyway, to be pure in the sense of not to know about other people, not to know about other alternatives, not to be open to adjusting to different contexts and to different you know, to different situations. Nobody is pure, and nobody should be pure if that's what pure means. I would suggest that these terms pure and authentic and, you know, and all of that should refer to whether or not the teaching and the practices are effective, whether or not they are helping. And they won't be effective and they won't help if we're in denial about the realities of our world. Another question from Singh. How would one use skillful means in discussing the second type of grasping with someone of a formal religion bound by formal rules? Second kind of grasping is the grasping to Shila and Vritta, And, you know, the point is similar to the first question, I think, that Singapore had. You know, there is a purpose to grasping, in a sense, to adhering to, you know, rules and regulations that help discipline ourselves, that help discipline us to lead happier lives rather than unhappy lives. A discipline that helps us to do what we know we should do instead of just following our untrained inclinations. There's no substitute for that. And that's, if you want to call it grasping, you can call it grasping. That's a good form of grasping. What I think the intention is by calling this a grasping is that, you know, that you can, it's a possibility. It's maybe even a temptation, strong temptation, to get very close-minded about those rules and regulations, and to say, you know, among other things, you know, my way of practicing, my moral code, and my, you know, vrittas, my disciplines and practices are the only ones that are correct, that they are superior to anyone else's, and so forth. They're, you know, to legitimate some kind of fundamentalist understanding, rather than to see them simply as useful aids. And if they cease to be useful aids, then you abandon them. Like the Buddha said, you know, the Dharma is like a raft. You know, he meant that image in a number of, I think he meant to convey a number of things with that image. The raft works, you see, the raft floats. So the Dharma is like a raft, and it floats, and it can take you across the river of suffering. But when it's done its job, then you let it go. You don't get attached to the raft, and so you don't get attached to, you know, your particular understanding of, you know, of ethics and of practice or of anything, you know, worldview or anything. You don't get attached to it, but you see it as useful, more or less useful, and more or less useful for a particular time and place. And when it ceases to be useful, then you change it, then you adapt it. That's Buddhism. Buddhism says that things change. Buddhism says that nothing has inherent, intrinsic, you know, qualities to them. And so if you're going to be a Buddhist, you would obviously not be grasping, I think, to Buddhism. I think I'm missing some of these. Can you?
Yeah, Kaypan, we have a question. If there's a chance, still no sound, though. So I think Singapore's back. So if Kaypan can try and ask a question, they don't have sound, so they can type it in if they want to as well.
So if Kaypan has a question, please type it in.
And
oh, there we go.
And perhaps while they're typing it in, can you hear this?
Yep,
can hear you, Lauren.
Lamaji, can you hear this? Yes, I have a question that I wrote out because I thought I was going to have to type it in. If this is to really be a global Buddhism, is there a method of being inclusive and respectful of those who prefer to be what you insular or fundamental and want to make a claim to authenticity, or are they outsider?
Well, that's a really awesome question, and it's a form of the great dilemma of of relativism. Everything's relative, if everything's relative, then are people who don't adopt relativism as a position, are we non-relative about that, about their non-adopting relativism as a position? And I think you have to say yes. You have to say that the ultimate criterion is that non-open understanding of Buddhism, is it a divisive force or a helpful force? You know, is it bringing more suffering to the world? Is it bringing more distance between people? Is it dividing people off? Or is it bringing people together? And it seems to me rather difficult, to imagine how a fundamentalist understanding of religion would not have divisive implications, would not have hierarchical implications, would not have divisive implications, would not conform to the criterion of utility. Does it help? Does it help bring less suffering and more happiness to people? It's a little bit difficult for me to see how that could be the case. Now, that doesn't, of course, mean that these, you know, people who, you know, have such closed ideas are no longer, you know, worthy of our compassion, worthy of being, you know, treated like, you know, like anyone, like any other human being. But just as we have compassion for people who are doing, you know, things that are obviously harmful to themselves and others, we have compassion for them, so too would we have compassion, I think, for the understanding of, you know, Buddhism that is bringing more pain, more divisiveness, more separation between people than less. And so they would, you know, there would be objects of compassion for us, people who adopt that kind of closed-minded fundamentalist, and I would regard it as a kind of, again, anachronistic, you know, completely, you know, kind of not realistic to the times. But if they have that understanding of Buddhism, then it seems to me that it would be difficult for that understanding of Buddhism not to bring more suffering than less in today's world. Pretty much obvious to me that it would be.
Can I ask a question?
Cindy's got a question here locally.
well, just because following on from Lauren's, but you're not saying, or are you, that somebody that defines themselves as a Tibetan Buddhist, for instance, is necessarily a fundamentalist?
No, it's not about that. No.
No.
No, it's not about, you know, I think it's perfectly fine to define yourself, of course it's fine,
yeah,
to define yourself as Tibetan Buddhist or, you know, Zen Buddhist or whatever kind of Buddhist you want. But, you know, to recognize that means also that understanding of Buddhism has been changed, has been affected by being put into a new context. So the thing that I'm arguing against, and the thing that I think is harmful, is the implication that the possible implication that if you're defining yourself as a Tibetan Buddhist, that you would, you know, then take another sort of step and say, and my Buddhism's better than yours, and my Buddhism's purer than yours, or my Buddhism's more authentic than yours, and that's not a useful thing anymore. That's that may never have been a useful thing, but it may have made more sense in a very, very closed situation in traditional Tibet, for example. But it makes no sense now in a global context, in a context where there is recognition of alternatives. You know, this is what one of the things that we mean by openness is that we all know that there are alternatives now, including, you know, people who are defining themselves as Tibetan Buddhists. They know that you know, that there are other forms of Buddhism, that there's Zen Buddhism, there's, you know, there's Theravada Buddhism, all kinds of forms of Buddhism, you know, Western Buddhism, there are all kinds of forms of Buddhism. And so the definition, even as a Tibetan Buddhist or a Zen Buddhist or something like that, is within a context of global Buddhism. That's what I would say.
K-Pan, what is the trick to adhering to the four Arya truths in our daily practice without grasping onto the results of the discipline or rules and regulations?
The results of the discipline and rules discipline, rules, and regulations ultimately would be freedom. That's what rules and regulations are supposed to bring you to the point where you don't need rules and regulations, where they have become so second nature. You see, the rules and regulations are used to retrain ourselves, to rewire ourselves. But once the rewiring is complete, then they've done their job, and they can be let go. And that is the goal. That's the whole purpose of them, actually. The purpose, the grasp, you see, the grasping to them means that you never get beyond them, that you never think that, you think that that rules and regulations are ends in and of themselves. They're not ends in and of themselves. They're means to an end. They're very, very important means to an end, but they're not ends in and of themselves. The end is freedom. That's what moksha means, liberation. That's what nirvana means. It means freedom from any kind of constraints, freedom from any kind of grasping, freedom from any kind of dissatisfaction. And so if the rules and regulations have done their job, then they will be completely interiorized. They will have made you a different person. And then you can let them go, just like the raft, you know. You can let them go because they've done their job. K-Pan, I think we lose it when the people...
No, that's about the tech.
That's a technical thing.
So Rick's asking if Sonia wants to go next.
Yeah. No questions here, says Sonia.
Wow.
Hi, Alicia.
So my question has to do with scriptural support for what you were talking about, this idea of Buddhism being an evolving religion or ethic or way of life. Do you have something that's explicit other than all things are changing?
Well, I did quote from one of the Pali Suttas to the effect that that the Dhamma can be gauged by whether it brings about beneficial results, and that understanding I think is found in a lot of Buddhist texts that the principle of utility is the only real measure of whether it's Dhamma or not, whether it's Dharma, whether it's truth or not. There's another text I've taught it in the past. It's another Pali text where the Buddha comes to a group of people. I think they're called the Kalimas, as I recall, and they've just had like endless Dharma teachers coming through their town, and so sounds familiar maybe to some of you, and so when the Buddha comes, they say like, well, why should we believe you? You say this, and other people say other stuff, and who should we believe? What's the measure? And the Buddha says much the same thing. He says, don't believe it. Don't believe it because it's in the scriptures. Don't believe it because I say so. You know, it's very radical, actually, that text. He says, don't believe it even if your guru says so, or even if it's in some scripture. Don't believe it because everyone else believes it. You know, see if it works. Does it pan out? Does it bring you a happier way of life or not? And that's really the only legitimate criterion. You know, and I think all of this makes fundamental sense, so to speak, in light of the structure of Buddhism that, you know, that you're looking at with your hand down. How else could Buddhism, you know, what other claim to authority could Buddhism have but utility, given the fundamental doctrines of change, of anatman, of the suffering that comes from craving and grasping, including grasping to things like worldview, to things like, you know, ethical systems and so forth. How else could Buddhism function except as a utilitarian, you know, changing, utilitarian-based kind of a evolving kind of a doctrine, given its fundamental nature, you see, given its genetic structure? How else could it possibly, you know, unfold? If not, only does it work. And what works, you know, can change. What works very, very much can change. So another implication of this, of course, also is that, you know, what works for us at one stage in our spiritual life doesn't necessarily have that same utility later. And so even in our own practice, in our own adoption and adaptation of Buddhism, we have to be willing to change. We have to be willing to let go of what was maybe once useful, but no longer has that kind of utility, and to have the courage to try what, you know, is new, but maybe more necessary, you know, as we evolve, you know, in our own spiritual practice. And we have huge resistance to this. We have huge resistance personally to this. We have huge resistance institutionally to this. We have huge resistance as human beings to change. We don't like it. We wish it weren't the case. You know, to the extent that we like change, we just want to, you know, we want to be in charge of it. We want to, like, you know, micromanage it so that it works out in the way we think it should. You know, but we sure don't like it. You know, we don't like to have to move beyond our comfort zones. And the purpose of Buddhism is to move us out of our comfort zone until we get into the great comfort zone. Okay? That's Nirvana. The great comfort zone. Of complete freedom and groundlessness. Okay, that's Nirvana. And that's the only comfort zone that we should be striving for. The other comfort zones that we find ourselves in, we have to constantly be willing to let go of them if we're going to make progress, if we're going to make spiritual progress. And clinging on to anything that, you know, that we hope will bring us some kind of, you know, stability, some kind of conservative stability and so forth, is a clinging, is a grasping, and will not bring anything other than suffering. That's a teaching of Buddhism.
I think Peter's going to try next.
Oh, yeah, good. Hey, Peter from Cape Ann. Let's see.
I find myself trying to breathe new life in ancient fossils. That's my predicament. Could you comment? I'm not Tibetan. But I'm kind of getting into reciting certain mantras. Could you comment on mantras and ancient Tibetan rituals and as they are pragmatic to us or not pragmatic?
Well, I think that depends on the individual. I think many of us, myself included, have gotten a great benefit out of you know, the participation in some forms of of ritual, Tibetan Buddhist ritual of mantra recitation and so forth, that these have had beneficial understandings, beneficial effects. But I think it's not so much the rituals or the mantras or anything like that that need to change. It's our contextualization of them. How can they help us in our daily lives? And if they're not helping us in our daily lives, then we need to rethink them. So I think it is possible that they can help us in our daily lives. So that said, there's no need to throw out stuff willy nilly just because it's in Sanskrit or the ritual isn't the one that we were brought up with. But that said, it is also possible to keep the practice, isolated from our daily lives by keeping it exotic, by keeping it foreign, by keeping it, strange and unusual. And then we do these, kind of exotic, strange things when we're doing our practice, and then we live the rest of our ordinary lives completely unaffected by the practice. You see what I mean? And that, I think, is a huge problem, and is a kind of a waste. It's a waste of the potential that the spiritual life has to change us in our ordinary lives, in our day to day lives, in our relationships with ordinary other people. So keeping it foreign, keeping it exotic, can keep it safe. Can keep it safe from changing us, and that I would argue is to not let it do its job. Its job is to change us from the inside out and to change every aspect of our lives, and to segregate it or isolate it or to keep it special. Okay, so I'll talk more about that in the next in the next talk in March. To inclusive Buddhism means that you're including also. It means you're keep and practical Buddhism in May is that you're integrating it into every aspect of your life. So that's a long-winded sort of answer to the question of I guess maybe the basic question is, should we just get rid of all the, Asian rituals if we're not Asian? Should we get rid of all the Asian rituals and all the mantras and all like that? Well, no, not necessarily. But we should understand them as being more or less useful in rewiring our daily lives, our ordinary lives. And if they're not useful, then we need to find something that will work. If they are useful, then fine, let's keep them. Sonia had a question here from Saskatoon, finally. Who is the happiest person you know? I don't know him, but Matthieu Ricard is supposed to be the happiest person on earth. You know him, that French monk?
She said that you know.
Although I don't know how Matthieu Ricard can be all that happy because they keep putting all those electrodes all in his head while he's meditating. It doesn't seem to me very happiness producing. But Shucking in, just going to join. Where are we at, Rick? What are we doing? Oh, Lindsay has a question. Yeah.
Lama, can you hear me? Yeah, okay. Thank you so much for this. Lauren and I were actually talking about something very similar today, that when this is a kind of release, we're being released from the rigidity of, or the possibility that something that we have acquired that has come from a place that appears to be foreign to us, that we have, because of the nature of the way Buddhism is taught, having a teacher and taking the teacher's authority, even to understand that on account of emptiness, that they're powerful. To what extent, you know, after going through advanced studies, etc., to what extent, when you're sitting there in a retreat and you're doing your mantra, and you say, I'm just off. I'm in some other realm. This is meaningless to me at the moment, right? There's, I think all of us have clung a bit in moments like that to what we have been taught, just do it. And yet when I'm saying opening prayers in my classes, I use modern American poetry because to me, I don't understand the Tibetan. And when I'm saying the Tibetan, I can't be thinking about what the Tibetan means at the same time. So I guess what I'm asking is, this seems to be a place of exploration and possibly individual exploration. And it will, in a certain way, change the nature of the relationship between the teacher and the student. So I just wanted to ask about that, because to surrender the authority to make kinds of decisions is part of the path, as I understand it, and also to test it out and find out what works for us is also part of the path, and that's a very fine balancing act, it seems to me. Could you speak to that?
Well, as Buddhism you know, repositions itself in a different context, as it has positioned itself in a different context, in a global context. One of the other, I think, implications, you know, and again, I think this maybe we can concentrate on this more in future conversations. But it seems to me that one of the implications is that Buddhism will no longer be primarily shaped by the monastic institutions that it once was shaped by in a more traditional context, and this is the case not just in you know, in the Western world, but in Asia too, that the framework, the monastic framework, and everything that kind of, you know, went with that is breaking down and is no longer that relevant, and I would for many people, for many practitioners of Buddhism, and so that means, among other things, that in a global context, the structure of Buddhism has to adjust to a more egalitarian and less hierarchical kind of set of assumptions that again are not peculiar to any one culture, but are definitive of the global culture that we live in. And in fact, you could say that globalism encourages rather than discourages the understanding of egalitarianism. The fact that we know about each other in ways that we have never been able to before, the fact that people can change whole governments by using Twitter, can bring down whole regimes. You know, this is egalitarianism at a level that we are unaccustomed to in world history. Democracy, and so Buddhism is going to, obviously, I think, have to adjust if it's going to be relevant. Again, if it's going to be relevant to the world that we live in, it has to adjust to the realities that the world, you know, isn't a closed hierarchical institution, that the world is a 7 billion person, you know, democratically oriented reality, and so, you know, that will, I think, have and has had already effects on our understanding of Buddhism and of the teacher-student relationship also, specifically. The teacher-student relationship can't be relevant in the same kind of way for us as it was in a monastic institution, where, you know, middle-aged or older men were training young boys, and that's kind of how it developed. That's how it developed in Tibet. That's how it developed in the Zen tradition. That's how it developed in lots of in all forms of Buddhism, traditional Buddhism in Asia, in a largely monastic or forest dwelling situation, as in Southeast Asia, but in one that was hierarchical. And closed in nature, hierarchical and closed, and our context is neither one, and so the teacher student relationship, I think, in Buddhism that will function beneficially for us will have to be adjusted. It'll have to be adjusted for our time and place, and it is being adjusted. In certain sort of internet chat, the idea that the age of the guru is over, has been thrown around quite a bit, and I think that that's probably true, that the age of the understanding, traditional understanding of the guru, has come and gone. And that we now have to kind of adjust our understanding of the teacher-student relationship to the modern realities. Now, that said, I've been in education my whole life as both a student and a teacher, and I believe in it. I believe that I believe in learning, you don't learn if you think you know everything, You learn by going to someone who you think knows something that you don't know, that you'd like to know, and you learn from them. And you respect them for what they, for the role that they're functioning, the role that they're enacting in your life. They are bringing you the opportunity to learn something that you couldn't learn otherwise. They are the vehicle. But to confuse the person with the vehicle, that I think is a big problem, and has shown itself to be a problem over and over and over again in the past few decades. That people divinize the person and not the role. And the real guru yoga isn't about a person; it's about a process, a process of learning, especially when it comes to spiritual process, the process of learning how to live a good life. Is extraordinary. It's way more extraordinary than learning how to play a violin. Learning how to live a good life is an extraordinary one. That process should be held special, held sacred, if you would. Okay, that process, but not to confuse the person with the process. And that's, I think, one way to start renegotiating the whole understanding of guru yoga and the teacher-student relationship. But I think it's ongoing. It's an ongoing discussion, and this is, I think, one of the principles. This and gender are among the biggest the biggest and most I think pressing of the adjustments that need to be made as we recontextualize Buddhism in a global setting, and in a global setting where that democratic and egalitarian kind of quality very much includes gender relations, and that also has not been the case. That's not the case in the insular, monastically oriented, parochial, provincial, culturally bound, forms of Buddhism of the past, and that's got to change. That definitely has got to change. Yeah, I think.
That was one of the first questions I remember ever seriously asking. Was up here. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear.
Can you hear me still? Okay. No, I thank you for that, because that was one of the first really serious questions I ever asked you when I first met you, was why did it appear that all the world's great religious leaders were men, when there were are so many extraordinary women on the planet. So I think we do have our work cut out for us, and I think this is a wonderful forum, because I think each center, all of us have been well educated, and now we need to begin to think for ourselves. It's time for that, and I think this is a great context that we can have an exchange about this, perhaps write about it to each other, and get on Mega Meeting Board. So thank you very much for this forum.
Thank you, Lindsay, and I would like to take this opportunity to encourage all of you to interact like this again with each other, and to utilize the kind of possibilities that we have now, to benefit each other. So the communication that we have available to us now should be exploited. This is also my understanding of Buddhism, especially of the Bodhisattva ideal, that we try to utilize whatever's at hand that will help us, bring us together. That will help, bring more harmony into the world and not less. To bring less divisiveness and more unity. And the possibilities that technology has brought us in the last, really very few years are, we're starting now to try to utilize them better. But, we have a lot of possibility that we're not really exploiting here yet. And this may be, kind of the tip of the iceberg of what we can do to truly, enact the traditional teachings of Buddhism, which is, to see the equality among all people, to understand that we're all the same, to truly understand that we now, I think, for the first time in world history, have that as a real prospect, as a real possibility. Because we are so tied in, we are so connected, and we can't maintain the kind of ethnocentric arrogance that we used to maybe be able to in closed situations, and that's good. And the more I think we can, learn to see each other in these widely geographical disparate places as leading pretty much the same kind of lives, the more compassion we'll have, the more empathy we'll have, the more understanding we'll have of our fundamental equality as human beings, no matter what we call ourselves, you see, beyond labels, no matter what national label we give ourselves, or cultural label or religious label, that living in a global age, we have uniquely now, I think, the opportunity to really understand at a very, very deep and visceral level the teachings of world spirituality when it comes to the equality that we all share as human beings. So I would encourage us all to increase the use of our capabilities, of our siddhis, our magical powers, and to use them for the benefit of ourselves and others, to bring more happiness to the world, to bring less divisiveness, more unity, and to think about how we're going to do that, as Buddhists. I mean, When I was thinking about that email, are you creating a new religion? The thing has been advertised as global Buddhism. Of course it's not a new religion. It's Buddhism. But what does Buddhism mean? What does Buddhism really mean in our daily lives, in the changed context that Buddhism now finds itself in, and that we have come to Buddhism, in the context that we live in. We've come to Buddhism in that context. And again, to just underline the point, it has to be relevant. It has to be made relevant to our lives, to the realities of our lives. So first of all, we have to recognize what the realities of our lives are. And we are living in a global context. There's no question about that. And secondly, what kind of How can we adapt Buddhism to the context that it now has found itself in such a way that it works for us? It brings us more happiness and less suffering, and brings those same two things to the people around us, and to the citizens of the globe, to the citizens of planet Earth, and to break down the old boundaries, to break down the boundaries that have kept us apart. And to see that we now have an opportunity, and again, it's a very extraordinary time we're living in, very unique time. We have an opportunity to enact a form of Buddhism that is beyond boundaries, that isn't limited by ethnocentric cultural boundaries, isn't limited by the kind of sectarianism that has always been a part of Buddhism because of different cultural contexts, you see? So now the cultural context is open. Now the cultural context is global. So what do we make of Buddhism in a global context? And, I don't have answers, suggestions, ideas, but, this is an evolving thing. And so we will all be working together, I think, hopefully, over the course of the rest of our lives, to try to make what we have been given, Buddhism, to make the spiritual tradition that we've been given into something that will really work for us, and will work for the people that we encounter, the ordinary people that we encounter. So I think maybe, if you don't mind, that'll be enough for today. And I appreciate especially the people that work so hard on the technology of making this happen. It went off pretty well. Could have been worse. And so I'm very, very grateful. And I'm grateful to all the people at the seven centers and Dharma study groups that participated. And I hope it was somewhat useful to you. It was useful to me to think about it, and I, of course, continue to think about it. And I thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts.
Thank you, Lamaji. We'll probably knock you off the air, but as you go, I'll try to do the big send-off so everyone can wave goodbye to you.
Okay.
So hang on.
Okay.
Comes Bye Bye Central, and
oh,
there they all are.
Oh, there's my mom.
There's Wendy, Wendy Lee.
Hi, Mom.
Where is everybody? That's LA. That's
LA. Reno, Australia. Cape Ann.
Cape Ann. Singapore.
Singapore.
Who are we missing?
Nashville's not there.
Nashville. Oh. All right, guys. Yeah, thank you all for joining us. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.